Thank you, Helen. Yes, if we turn to paper 8B, at the March meeting you asked us to further develop proposals with respect to when an entity should disclose information related to events or conditions that cast significant doubt on an entity's ability to continue as a going concern, and also what those disclosures should be. So this paper summarises the conclusions that have been used in developing those proposals. In this session, we'll ask you whether you agree with the key conclusions used in developing the proposals. We'll test the proposed disclosure trigger against some examples. And we'll ask you whether you agree with the staff recommendation to take these proposals to exposure drafts. So the first section is the summary of our conclusions. And they're discussed in paragraph 6 to 28 of the paper and summarised in paragraph 29. Now, the expected effect of these proposals is discussed in paragraph 30 and in paragraph 31. We conclude that, in our view, going concern as a basis for the preparation of the financial statements would be unaffected by these proposals. We're not intending to change the basis of preparation, which we think is clear and works well in practice. The going concern assessment as applied to an individual entity will remain unchanged. If the entity is a going concern now, it would be a going concern in the future. We have heard diverse views about the effect that the proposed disclosure trigger will have in current practice. And finally, when going concern disclosures are made, those disclosures in general include information about both components of the assessment, i.e. about the events or conditions and the mitigating actions. So, in general, the application of the existing going concern presumption will remain unchanged in financial statements. The exception to this is the proposal for an explicit disclosure trigger. We can look at the disclosure trigger in more detail as part of the second section. So, having said that, can I ask you whether you agree with the key conclusions referred to in question one on page 8 of the paper?
I really appreciate your analysis, and I really respect what you are going to achieve.
But
I wish we could achieve. That's the idealistic. However, I cannot really support your proposal, and especially about growth triggering events before the mitigating events. And actually, in Japan introduced this growth triggering going concern disclosures in 2003, and it ended up lots of boilerplate disclosures, and that made real serious going concern issues obscure. Actually, it is quite difficult to ask entity to disclose the going concern issue anyway. And therefore, if we have a lot of real unnecessary things, then the real one would be obscure. And if you are going to make some guidelines about what is the trigger event and what is the mitigation plan, or what is the existing plan, existing mitigation devices. But how can you segregate this is the plan or this is the existing? And it is quite difficult. And if we create some guidance or example, then constituents will keep asking, how about this one? So what about this? It's going to be a never-ending story. To my sense, this is not really the part of the accounting standard. And I understand IS 1, paragraph 25, already requires disclosure. And that's fine. That is the part of the accounting standard. But the guideline, what is the triggering event, or what is the significant uncertainty, is not really the area of accounting standard. So this is the area of audit standard or the regulator's job. So in this sense, I cannot support
Martin.
Yeah, I also don't agree with the proposal, and I think if we're doing that, having a disclosure trigger really before management action, I think it's not appropriate, because we're reporting about companies, and excluding management action, I think, is not a good reporting. We always integrate and doing after management action. And I think if we're doing that, I think it will end in, agree with TAC, in a kind of boilerplate disclosure, because it is likely the same as when you know regarding the SEC requirement on risk factors. I think this will end in the same kind of story, that people will really report all kind of this risk, and then maybe then endless discussion, okay, what they can do about that. And third, I think, okay, it's really kind of then self-fulfilling prophecy, and we heard also in the Global Prepare Forum meeting that people said, okay, if we're doing that, and if management has action like right issuance or selling of core assets or whatever to mitigate, I think then the prices will be impacted by this kind of disclosure, because it is a kind of stress selling then, and I think that is negative consequences if you're doing that. And I think it's not useful, because that's my main argument. Companies are managed by management, and if we starting to do reporting without management action, I don't know if that is really useful.
John Wu.
Thank you. I agree with Martin and Doc. So actually, if you see the page, maybe there's a line, you separate the four blocks there in the first column, circumstances, and the last two blocks that they're I guess we should focus on separate these two events, you know, they are of this, the third part block and fourth block. But our suggestion might be, you know, to confuse our users to separate, identify each event. The real event that we should let investors know is maybe the last block. So that even though we have some mitigating actions, if we cannot avoid the uncertainty, material uncertainty, that is the real issue. The market would like to know. But if we do adopt your approach, then maybe users might miss very important information. So at least I would like to suggest that, you know, maybe that net effect, net triggering, net effect approach might be better rather than growth approach. But if we cannot accept that net approach, then we might think about the separate maybe labeling of these two events when you make a disclosure, at least. That's what I suggest.
Martin, just on your point about management, are you talking about in paragraph 33 where it says even if management's got a plan?
I discussed in paragraph 18 with the proposal. 18. It's okay to have the triggering event. It's on the event before taking into account any mitigating management action.
Yeah, but
it's a proposal.
I can see the argument that this might lead to excessive disclosures and cover your behind disclosures. But I don't think your argument that it excludes management's actions is correct, because you will disclose those as well. So,
yeah, but as a trigger event, I think it's. But we're starting disclosing about, okay, is there an event and taking into account not management action? And then if we have triggers, this trigger, then we disclose both. I accepting that. But I think really it should be after management action, and then if there is uncertainty, then we should disclose.
So you're going the net way rather
net,
than
yeah.
The
yeah. And that is what I think is okay, what we're doing all the way, because we're taking into account management action and then we report.
Well, we are talking here about future management action. So
yeah, okay. But we're talking about future stuff here, going concern is future. If that was already bankrupt, you don't have to disclose it.
German logic.
Hello, lot has been said already, I won't repeat that. If I were in the situation that I received information that one of our business partners were perhaps at risk of going into bankruptcy within 12 months, I would put them on a cash on delivery immediately. I would even consider to not deliver to them before I had a certainty that they would somehow take care of customer situations as well. Or if it was a supplier, I would be really, really worried and immediately ask people to look for other suppliers. So I think that this will trigger actions from people that are really putting this company, that is perhaps a sound company, because I think a lot of companies are in a situation that they have these gross exposures on almost a daily basis, put them into jeopardy of collapsing. So I think then it's good to understand what problem are we trying to fix, and I think that's a good starting point. So I asked staff when we started discussing this, could we have a couple of good examples? And we couldn't find any. Well, we found a few well-known cases of bankruptcies, but evidently we had the good documentation that they were into a bad situation. So then we turned to some friends we have around in Europe and said, could you please give us a couple of good examples? So we got from market regulators good examples. Well, we got from one country good examples of no problems. This worked well. Another country, we said, we have one case, and it seemed to work well. There are some doubts because I didn't update the information. We got one example which was crooks, and I can read if you want to what one man in the management wrote to another man in the management. You shouldn't write mails like that. And it ended, so the only thing I can do is to fill them up with lies and nonsense. That is talking about the bankers and regulators and the accountants, because otherwise this will collapse. Crooks will not be caught by this. Then we had one of the most spectacular failures of the bank during the financial crisis. 8 months after they made one of the biggest acquisitions in the European banking history, they ran into lack of money. I don't think that management 8 months before would have issued something that we might be an ongoing concern 6 or 12 months from now. And then there was finally the sixth case. It was a bank that 4 years earlier had got state subsidies to survive, and they had made periodic presentations of their problems, and then finally 4 years later, when they became rumored in the market, they would collapse. Savers took out their money. These were the cases we saw, and I can say I don't see that this is really a solution we are looking for. We are looking for to create problems for honest people. So what is then the right solution? Well, I open our blue book here. Everyone knows about it. I read on page B1992. There is a headline which says Resources, Risk and Relationships. It says about risk. Sorry for taking some time here. Management should disclose the entity's principal risk exposures and changes in those risks, together with its plans and strategies for bearing or mitigating those risks. Continues. We have it in here, in what we recommend people to have in a management commentary. And that is where it fits in. To go down with this proposal here is absolutely wrong. I don't support it.
Philippe.
Well, I may be one of the few supporters. At least the first one to speak in support. But I would like to make a preliminary remark. It seems to me this is a difficult project. As we heard, there are a lot of arguments against, and probably some in favor, which we tried to explain. I will recommend we decouple this initiative from the other disclosure initiative, IS1. We want in IS1 materiality, notes, to achieve quick results with a goal to reduce disclosures. Here we are more talking about increasing disclosures, so it's a bit inconsistent with the overall initiative of reducing disclosures. And people might not understand the link between this going concern initiative and the overall goal of reducing disclosures. I think we can have quick wins with the other part of the disclosure initiative. This one would be more difficult to manage, and we would have to proceed with caution. And even if there is a majority around this table, which is a bit in doubt at the moment, it will take some time to achieve anything. So I would not like this initiative to hamper or to slow down the initiative on the disclosure. Now, why I am in favor? I understand the business aspect. I understand the risk for businesses in disclosing this kind of product. It is very sensitive information. But I think our priority should be given to shareholders, investors, not to the management. And I know we're creating, if we do that, some difficulties for managers to provide very sensitive information which might be misinterpreted and would create overreactions from some actors in the market. And that might be, in the end, at the detriment of shareholders themselves, because they will suffer from any overreaction in the marketplace. So the question is, what kind of disclosure? And we should avoid the boilerplate type of disclosure that Tak mentioned, which is found everywhere in the filings, in the prospectuses. You have dozens of pages written by lawyers about boilerplate risk, and that is useless information. We want to focus on what is really meaningful, important for investors, what they must know as investors when dealing with a company. And this is why the description of what will trigger the growth disclosure is very, very important. And I think April set out three cumulative conditions, and I think in paragraph 21 we have three criteria, because they are linked by N. It has to be very big in terms of impact, it has to be likely, and it has to be short term in terms of timing. Three conditions for that to happen. And even if there are plans in place to address those issues, to be silent in the disclosures, or to say, oh, we can rely on management commentary, which, by the way, is not a standard, is not required by us to address this issue. I think it's just not doing a good service to investors. So the question is, then is, I think, looking at the table in paragraph 30, the first box you say, of course, you are not a going concern, you are not in the scope. You are still a going concern that there are no such conditions, no such problems, of course, no disclosures needed, none. Then you have the third situation where you have realistic alternatives to continue, so you are a going concern, but you have growth conditions and you have a plan, and after taking into account this mitigating factor, you say, okay, I have no remaining uncertainty, I'm fine. And this is where maybe the question of whether to disclose or not really is important. The fourth and last category, you have growth conditions that trigger a risk about the going concern, you have a plan, but you still have material uncertainties after applying those mitigating factors. I would say, obviously, here we need to disclose. And by the way, the auditors probably will disclose. The report of the auditors will point to those material uncertainties that remain after taking into account the mitigating factors. So for me, there is no doubt that this should be disclosed. Now, where I'm not fully sure, and I think we need to expose and to try and discuss it, is when you have no material uncertainties remaining after taking into account the mitigating factors. Is it really needed then to disclose that, yes, I have a problem, but I'm sure I can manage it, so I'm fine? This is where I'm not sure in terms of the scope of this disclosure.
It's a great meta-argument.
Yeah, that category, this intermediate category, the third situation considered in this paragraph, the net assessment, I'm fine. So maybe I don't need to disclose here. But if after taking into account the growth, the mitigating, and the net, I'm still uncertain, then for sure I'm not disclosed.
But isn't that the present circumstance?
Yeah,
yes,
I think the question is really, today people will talk about the net, but will not explain all the story behind it. They will say we have a material uncertainty, but we are not sure that there is proper explanation of what is all the elements of this discussion. And I think I'm rather supportive of addressing the intermediate situation where you have no material uncertainties remaining and still going to the disclosure of the growth. I'm supportive of that. But I understand this is a real difficulty in this project, and we have to balance very, very carefully the benefits on the cons, on the drawbacks of this proposal in terms of the impact which might be unintended on the company. So the how to do this disclosure is very difficult. You know.
Can I just say that one of the reasons that we eventually did go for an explicit gross trigger for disclosure is two or threefold. In some jurisdictions, people currently do use a gross trigger as their basis. We were concerned when we did outreach at the beginning of the project that three jurisdictions came back and said that if at the end of the day you prepare the financial statements on a going concern basis, then there is never any reason to make disclosures because you can't have any residual uncertainty. So that was a concern. The other reason that we did go for the gross disclosure was the fact that there is so much, we felt there was so much judgment involved when management are looking at the mitigating actions, and that the mitigating actions may be so outside their normal operating experience that we were concerned that they may not be able to reliably assess how feasible or how effective those operations would be, and that if we didn't disclose until after management had decided how effective their actions would be, we would actually be disclosing too late, or we would lose a lot of information that went into that process. So that was.
This is why I support that we expose this idea. I think it is beneficial to investors, but I do recognize the difficulty of this kind of disclosure and the risk of market overreaction, which would then prove, in fact, detrimental to shareholders.
Beryl?
I think Felice has said a lot of what I would have said. I think I agree a lot with what you said, and I agreed with the soft paper when I read it originally. I do agree with the points people have made about the caution we have to take with boilerplate disclosure. But my concern would be, I think, the one that April mentioned last year, that it's if you have gone through a process of believing you have a real risk to going concern, and you think that you have future mitigating factors, I think it's useful information for the market to assess whether those mitigating factors are appropriate. I just wanted to pick up on Jan's couple of examples, and it seems to me the first one that he mentioned is the one of a supplier supplying to a company, where the company has a severe going concern issue which they've managed to introduce mitigating factors. And Jan said, well, in that circumstance, he would stop lending to that customer. And I would ask the opposite question, is that if the company had those severe concerns and had mitigating factors that you weren't comfortable with but didn't disclose it, would you feel like you'd been duped if you had lent to them? And it feels to me that if it's information that somebody is going to act on, it is useful information, and our task is to provide useful information that people will act on. So I agree one of the concerns here is overreaction, but maybe overreaction is a concern because we don't give that kind of disclosure now. So people haven't learned how to evaluate a going concern disclosure with mitigating factors. The second example you gave was the one of the directors that were being dishonest with their users of financial statements. And I suspect the reason they were able to be dishonest was because the communication that they were doing was outside of their financial statements. It wasn't part of the audited process. So they were able to communicate by phone or by whatever other nature with those users because they didn't have to worry about that audit oversight. An oversight onto that type of communication might have actually been able to produce information that was different.
Well, these guys are in jail now where they are just being searched by the police. But well, I have a lot of respect for that people must inform, and I would perhaps feel duped if I was not aware of certain situations if it was really an important business partner. And that's where I think it fits in well into this with the management commentary. This has also been when we made that section, it was a lot of quarreling with the market regulators, because the market regulators said this is our duty to see that the whole picture, your duty is to make the financial statement. My main concern is the headline. It says that going concern, my company might fail within the coming 12-month period. These are the situations. I'm much more open to say that you should have a proper and good description of your business risks and what you're doing to take care of it. That's very well written into this part that I read from. So what we should do in such a case, that if we think that this is not working, and then I think it's good let's see now the cases where things are blown up in the face of people, and let's search more for this and to get proof that this really is a problem. Then I think we should take the text we have and we should bring it in somewhere in a more neutral place, not saying that this company might go down within a 12-month period. That's where I'm worried. But I don't mind at all that we force people to describe their business risk, etc.
Danielle, I think we're not necessarily talking about the principle. We think there should be, in principle, some sort of disclosure about going concern issues. We're more talking about where we put it and how we do it.
No, well, I think there's, for me, it's a big difference between a going concern and the business situation risk. I think Philip is coming much closer to me when he says that he takes the net situation here. Of course, the net situation, when you have remaining doubts, it should be extensive descriptions of that. But I mean, take a company that has a big bond falling due 9 months down the road. The financial markets are not very stable. And there is, of course, a risk that the banks will not find a new solution to this. And if so, they are going down. Of course, that should be described, and of course, people should be made aware of that. That is the situation. And if it is considered to be really without a solid solution, yes, then perhaps it is a going concern problem. But there must also be situations where you can say that the markets are more or less okay. We have no reason to expect that 9 months down the road we won't be able to raise this money. Then I don't think you should put it under a title saying this company might go down the drain 9 months from now because we have a big bond falling due, but we're not worried because we'll find the money. And then of course some people will overreact. But I think that should be brought into under another title, another headline, which is business risks and management.
Do you think that situation would meet the trigger?
Well, I don't know all the auditors, but I know enough auditors to say that there are some people who are forcing things into exactly where they have covered up some of their big pet body parts.
Gary?
I'm actually sensitive to the need to do something, but I don't think this is it. For many of the reasons already expressed, and I won't keep many of them. I think, as I look at the chart on page 30, it seems to me that there's almost like a third category. You've got the first one, no alternative but to cease trading or liquidate. And then the other one is, there are really no alternatives. Seems to me there's a third category. You might not cease trading or liquidate, but when you're done, the company will be 10% of what it used to be. It's still trading. Isn't liquidated. Now, maybe it's subsumed in the other three boxes here, but when it talks about there are realistic alternatives, it seems to me, I mean, at least my way of thinking, there's an inference that something close to where you are today might come out. So I'm wondering, is there a third category, and I don't know how to express it, but basically what comes out, what finishes, bears no semblance other than perhaps the name to what started. I think, I'm sure where Jan is, I think the right solution is enhanced risk and or liquidity disclosures more prominent in the footnotes, say note 2, assuming note 1 will still be accounting policy. And I think I really do think this runs the risk of becoming self-fulfilling if you've got a going concern footnote name or something. I think under liquidity and risk is a better way to do it. And Jan had mentioned, supplier. There's also long-term purchasers issues. It's one thing if you sell a retail product, stays on the shelf a brief period of time and it's bought. But if you sell airplanes or automobiles, there's a doubt. When people think about, you can honor my warranties, or you can be around to service it and have spare parts and on, is you're going to be less inclined to want to buy that product because you're wondering, will they be there? several years from now, and I think in response to what Philippe said, and I acknowledge the point, actually I think you are doing the shareholders a service, not setting up a set of circumstances that might enhance its opportunity to become self-fulfilling. So I'm sort of, you know, sort of thinking I would deal with more liquidity and risk disclosures more prominent in the footnotes as the solution, as opposed to this, I thought.
Okay. Just as an aside, in the conceptual framework when it discusses going concern, it does mention the possibility that you can also be in a going concern position where you can't expand the business and support the business and you have to reduce the business. So there is that concept of a dying animal rather than a cessation animal. Just also to say that one thing that we have noticed when we've been talking to people about this is that the sort of model that I think currently exists for listed entities in the US, where you're required to fill in a business risk statement, is generally viewed as being quite unsatisfactory, because there you do get boilerplate and voluminous anti-litigation.
I agree with you, and yeah, I was doing reporting when that act came out in the mid-1990s, and it took a few years of time, but it was out of a private securities reform litigation in Safe Harbor, and the attorneys had field days, you know, with, you know, every list of horribles you could possibly think of, you know, in the risk disclosures, because you were given a safe harbor. So it got to be lengthy and boilerplate. That is not the right, you know, solution to this.
Wait, go.
I support the Tucker Martin analysis view. First, I should say, is any time we discuss disclosure, it's hard to deny any suggestion is not useful. Of course useful, you know, as many as possible useful. But the question for us is whether we do need to require. For me, I have two major concerns. One is the type of, let's say, boilerplate, the type of disclosure. I linked it to our discussion several years ago when we discussed the third-party exemptions required by China. And interestingly, by the end, you know, Borgnine dissent. And in the whole process, Borgnine support. And I said, well, why is dissent by the end? Borg say, you know, I just opened the dissent opinion, you know. You know, say, you know, the current requirement is actually combined necessary and unnecessary information together. And you can see the word you're not that safe, you know. And you ask people to disclose anything, but what are those information really useful? Not disclose at all. And during the discussion that time, I, you know, copied many of the disclosure, actual disclosure by Chinese companies, banks in Hong Kong and in New York. And most of them only disclose about 15 to 20 pages. And before we give them exemption. But if purely based on our requirements, you know, maybe 100 pages is not enough. And actually, when the largest oil company in China went to US for listing, and initially SEC required about one-third of the prospective disclosures in related to the public transactions. By the end, you know, SEC gradually reduced the amount. And so by the end, all of the companies in China, in the US and in Hong Kong, this goes about 15 to 20 pages. And they are not falling in line with the party disclosure requirements. What I want to say is, you know, some of our requirements looks like we want to ask people to disclose useful information. But by the end, you know, Tucker says, commingled useful and early non-useful, and I don't think it's appropriate. And secondly, I do worry about duplications of disclosure. Mm-hmm. And some of you mentioned about, you know, the liquidity disclosure and others. I try to figure out how many places we have such kind of disclosure. You know, we have a financial risk disclosure in financial instrument standards, and in conservation standards, and the related party disclosure, not purely on the going concern. And as I remember, the securities regulator normally will require except the section on commitment and lawsuit. And in addition, in China and also in the US, you know, every company must have a 1 or 2 page highlight in front of the annual report called significant risk. And if we additionally want such a comprehensive disclosure, I do feel, you know, there were a lot of duplication among them. So this is why I want to talk another.
Amaru?
Excellent. I'm not going to repeat a lot has been said. I'll just express what I said to the staff when we discussed this small group meeting. I'm quite happy with the general principle in IS-1. I think it works well, and I'm not convinced that there's a lot of problems with the going concern right now. I do respect the origin of the request for clarification coming from the auditors, IWSB. I think you did a great job in trying to frame this, but I do agree with many aspects of WEGU assessment on the duplication of disclosures. I think this is, for me, much more similar to a regulator's overreaction to imaginary cases, because there are no real cases whatsoever show to me that we do have a problem here.
Okay,
WEGO and a few others had concerns about boilerplate, and that was something that we thought about and were also concerned about, and which really led us to those filters, if you like, that are in the paragraph one of the paper about the magnitude, the likelihood of timing. And what I would suggest is that, you know, if these are not sufficiently filtering out those boilerplate disclosures, then I would say we could look more at that or adding application guidance associated with that to make sure that we're getting the disclosures that are needed.
Eric?
I support the staff's proposal, and I think this is something that we should go ahead with. I think right now, going back to April's recap of the results from the outreach when the project was started, I think the problems of you never have to, the three, I think you said, jurisdictions, you never have to disclose if you conclude that going concern basis is appropriate. I think that's there are a misunderstanding of the current requirements. I think we're not trying to address those, but I do have a problem as we've worked through it with the idea that I don't have to say anything about I might have an illness until I'm in the hospital and in intensive care and told I might not survive, which is, I think, the consequence of saying there is no disclosure requirement until there's a net conclusion that material uncertainties remain. So for me, I think it is an improvement that we're proposing, and I think it is a change to say it's the filtered events or conditions that trigger disclosure requirements, and there should be separate discussion of what those events and conditions are and what the planned mitigating effects are. I think that my assessment of what the staff has proposed is that we have the right filters, and in particular the first one where we're focusing on the significance of the impact rather than how big is the event itself. I understand the concern about self-fulfilling prophecy. I think it's probably related to where we are now, because if you only have a discussion of that there are threats to my ability to continue as a going concern when you're in intensive care and told you may not survive, I'm not surprised that that's how the market reacts. I think it would be healthy to point out that if we were to go as the staff proposes to a gross rather than net disclosure approach, that it's perhaps more appropriately characterized as a discussion under basis of preparation rather than alert, going concern problem. But I think it is something that we should move forward with, and I think the staff has done a good job in terms of the package that they've brought to us, and I think that we should move forward with it.
Okay. You know, first of all, I should congratulate one more time April's stupendous efforts in doing it. Of course, Michael gladly leading the support. I think it's rather unfortunate that we are still stuck in this for almost a year without any change in the decision making. I personally feel that what April has put forward in her paper is strongly sensible and highly warranted. One question for you to help those people who talk about self-fulfilling prophecies, April, is there any academic evidence in those three jurisdictions that you mentioned which do broad presentation, which have made more companies go bankrupt or anything like that? Is there any credence to that self-fulfilling prophecy?
There's no actual academic research that supports that view. There is, most of the academic research is what is the effect of qualified audit reports on, or emphasis of matter audit reports on the subsequent health of an entity, and there's generally not much evidence of that. But a lot of the research is out of date, so it's really quite difficult to actually say, to point to any research one way or the other.
I'll tell you from an ex-auditor's point of view about the self-fulfilling prophecy, and I just want to be quite clear, and I have one particular example which is seared in my memory from an audit I have done in the past. This company was in the wind turbine industry. So they have long arm wind blades, and the blades developed a crack. Okay, blades developed a crack, and then the question came about, and we were discussing at the audit table, is this a defining event for this company? Because once the cracks develop in the blades, they fall off and they have all kinds of problems. Then we discussed, and I remember it so well, is this a self-fulfilling prophecy if we disclose it? But then the conclusion there was that if an auditor puts it in his opinion, then perhaps you are pushing it, but a company not disclosing it would be a more not faithful representation of what's happening. You tell about the problem, you tell about what mitigating event, leave it to the users to understand how they are going to do it. If, for example, if you do not want to leave anything to the users to understand it, I question the very basis for any disclosure. Okay, that is to enhance the understanding of the financial statement. Why do we need IFRS 8?
I mean, we have outreach to investors and comments from investors that show that they think information about going to CERN is extremely important to them.
I completely agree.
We've also had the comments back from investors that when an entity is in trouble, it isn't a surprise. They know it's in trouble. And in their view, if they had disclosure about what the issues were and what management plans to do about it, that would actually alleviate their concerns rather than make it worse. We also have had sort of anecdotal evidence that concerns about going concern are much more widespread. There was a survey done in Australia where 20% of audit reports in a second-tier market had some reference of emphasis of matter about going concern in the report. And also, of course, we're aware that this topic is viewed by a number of people as being important. There's been the Sharman Committee in the UK, and the FRC are consulting on this. The FASC have gone to exposure draft in this area, and they are will start re-deliberating on their final proposals in January. So it is something that a number of people perceive as being important from a disclosure and reporting point of view.
You definitely stole my last sentence on this. I think one thing we have to remember is that we are only talking about significant doubts, not about routine matters. And you have been very, very clear in your paper, and I just wanted to reemphasize it. You mentioned about Sherman Committee's thing, FRC, IAASB, US FASB doing it. For the first time, they're moving something from their auditing standards to the accounting standards. Remember that so far in the US, it is only an auditing standard. They're bringing it to an accounting standard because first the management should do something, then the auditor should do it. None of these things are going to change from my discussions with IAASB that they are proposing anything, a gross evaluation in their audit report. Their audit report is continues to be on a net basis. Their evaluation is on a net basis. If there's anything residual, they will put an emphasis of matter. I really think, given the political issue around this, with the financial crisis, with the others doing something, us not even moving to an exposure draft would be a disaster. We do an exposure draft, we receive what it is. If it is such overwhelming as the some of the board members feel strongly about it, then we will think about it. But I think at this stage, not even going to an exposure draft, and this is only an exposure draft, I think we are not serving our constituents well.
Now that you mentioned this financial crisis, which is indeed one, I think, one of the reasons why this whole discussion has come up again.
Yes.
Prior to the, I'm going to give a speech 2 weeks from now in which I say this episode was the biggest case of mass cognitive dissonance in economic history, because almost nobody saw even the growth danger, let alone management in the banking industry did not see how dangerously leveraged they were. So they were not doing anything about it. And even with this new standard, they would not have disclosed anything at all. So, you know, even this possible improvement would not have addressed the issues that we are trying to address.
Would it be a step in the right
direction? I came into this meeting with a favorable attitude towards the proposals. I am much more skeptical now, having heard the discussion, and I am worried that it could lead to, even with the best of intentions and with these filters, that it could lead to a lot of boilerplate disclosures. In Japan, every company risks being hit by an earthquake. You know, are they going to have to report on that, including all the measures they take to evacuate their personnel and stuff like that? It is dangerous. Nevertheless, I would be willing to try an exposure of these proposals and see what the reactions of the markets are. Some of them are predictable. All investors will say, we want this, and many preparers will say, well, this will lead to a lot of unnecessary disclosure, so I'm not sure if it's going to help very much. Nevertheless, I'm willing to give it a go, but I must say I'm very skeptical. I also see the arguments in favor, and so I'm saying I'm skeptical. I'm not completely convinced it is a bad idea either. So I'm willing to test the idea, but I am skeptical. Patricia?
I think we should move forward with this as an exposure draft. This is something that the investment community has expressed concern about. I think in light of the financial crisis, there is an increased lack of confidence in management, and I think that perhaps this could, again, improve confidence in management if there were more open discussion about risks that they were facing and what steps they were taking to mitigate them. I do share the concern about duplication of disclosure in some areas or proliferation of boilerplate, and that would dilute what I see as the benefit of moving forward with this. I think professional analysts and investors often see these gross risks before even managements are aware of them. As Hans said, in the financial crisis, that they seemed to miss the fact that they were over-leveraged, but that was pretty obvious with hindsight looking at their financial statements. So saying they were over-leveraged would have been, in effect, a duplication of disclosure, but I do think we should move forward with this exposure draft because it is a concern in the investment community, and I think being more open and honest about the growth material risks that they're facing and what they're doing to mitigate them would improve credibility in the financial markets with management.
I've joined the unvocal minority and agree that we should proceed. I've heard from Jan you would almost take it out of the voluntary management commentary if you say there's no problem and you're going to create a problem. Others say do nothing. Gary says let's go and look at all the other disclosures and see how we can strengthen them. I think I'm relatively happy about the triggers that have, and the filter that's been put in, and I think we should put it out as an exposure draft and see what the market says.
John Wu?
I think, you know, the effort did a very good job in analyzing all these issues, but in theory I agree with you. But I guess there we should see the limitations of financial statements. This is not timely, you know, statement. At least there we can, at most we can have about 3 month interval information. So this is a good area we have to see all other disclosure requirements in each jurisdiction. I guess they have a good disclosure package of the each jurisdiction. They might ask some more instantaneous disclosure if you have a problem. So it seems to me this is a general financial statement, just disclosed every 3 months. So maybe, you know, our purpose is to provide a kind of confirmation, maybe, you know, information rather than we are showing their good, useful information to predict. There is an uncertainty, material uncertainty. So maybe that's why I think, you know, in the beginning when we started this discussion, this area is maybe not a good area we can help a lot to market to focus to this material uncertainty. So that's why I'm suggesting a kind of a net trigger approach rather than having a general approach. If we just suggest a general approach, then maybe markets might be, you are doing too much. You know, this is not your responsibility of the ISB. You know, general financial statements are not for good use. So you are giving a kind of a more burdensome, you know, unnecessary burdensome to companies and the markets. So maybe, you know, we can do that. You know, we can propose a more quite ambitious, you know, solution approach in exposure draft. But the fears, maybe some resistance or some loss of reputation of our board. You know, maybe you are thinking, you know, too idealistically, you know, too theoretical. You know, you do not think about the practical issues. There are many mechanisms to show this kind of a phenomenon to market. So why don't you respect us? You do not solve every problem in market. So maybe, you know, that's the, I'm thinking. You are now theoretically correct if we see this area of the ISB, but there are all kinds of mechanisms outside. That's why I'm suggesting you might have to be more compromised.
Yeah, man. I think what we have discussed, man, clearly this kind of information is somewhat useful, but it is already given in MD&As, in the security prospectus, whatever. So this information is there, that is what I think. But we want to give this information under, and what Jan says, under the heading, maybe I'm in 1 year dead. And that is, if you give it under that heading, and that I think is what we have to discuss, is then a cross disclosure more appropriate to triggering this disclosure or a net. And what Mary said, for example, in patient or that someone is ill and after intensive care in the hospital, maybe somebody wants to know it, but if you want to tell something, is there a risk that I'm in 1 year dead, and if I have medicine and the risk is mitigated that I don't be in 1 year dead? I think under this heading it is not relevant. Maybe under other risks it is relevant, but we are doing that under this heading, and that is really the problem here.
Can I see who does not agree with the staff recommendation? Okay, well, it's not going to fly.
Yep, okay.
Sorry, April.
That's all right. I'll have
it was a good effort.
Okay.